From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Jennifer Cation Armstrong returns to the show this week. She's the author of many fine books, including the indispensable When Women Invented Television, the untold story of the female powerhouses who pioneered the way we watch today, as well as biographies of your favorite TV shows and films, including Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic, Seinfeldia, how a show about nothing changed everything, So Fetch, the making of Mean Girls, and why we're still so obsessed with it, and Sex and the City and Us, how four single women changed the way we think, live, and love. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's always nice to be here.
Unfortunately, because your books have these marvelous subtitles, that's all the time we have.
Well, we work very hard on those subtitles, so it's not for nothing.
So when The Godfather Part 2 came out, it was like the first sequel ever that was like worth watching. And it was like, wow, sequels could actually be great. And then came The Godfather Part 3, and I was like, oh. So you wrote a wonderful book about a show called Sex and the City. And then there was a sequel. First, there were two movies. And then there was a sequel television series. And that series has just come to an end. So I thought it'd be a nice time to have you on to reflect about not just the ending of this series, but about Sex and the City in general.
Absolutely.
So was this series a Godfather Part 2 or a Godfather Part 3?
It was definitely a Part 3. There's just no getting around it. It's an odd feeling when it's a television show and it's three seasons. It was over like many years, you know, it was longer than 3 years that we got these. And it just was so, because you could kind of always have hope, like, oh, anytime now, like I'd see like a glimmer of hope and I'd be like, they're going to turn it. It's not like a 2 hour movie where you're kind of like, oh, at least this will be over in 2 hours. It's just, this was one of the strangest, maybe the strangest, viewing experiences of my life, fandom experiences of my life, and coverage experiences of my life, because it was just such a unique to its time kind of thing.
Well, let's review. First, let's talk about Sex and the City. Why in general do you think Sex and the City was such an important show? I got a bunch of questions. Who was its target audience, and how did it sort of manifest over years rather than just be a show that, remember that show that was on once, but it was rather,
right.
Something, yeah.
Right. That's people still, I mean, granted, it's in some ways, I feel like young people, maybe making fun of it or at least parts of it when they rewatch it now, but they're still like rewatching and I think emotionally connecting on some level as well. Yeah, it was so important. And this is one of those where you have to kind of like time travel to understand why it was so important, because it looks kind of normal to us now, but it set the standard. You know, there's been a million shows since that are young people talking about sex, even women specifically talking about sex. This is a show that had four single women at its center. It was very clear about the fact that they were all over 30. I know that, again, doesn't sound crazy to us now, but at that time, to have women in their 30s and 40s who were independent and professional and successful and didn't show any real signs of needing men, you know, they dated a ton and they had tons of sex, but they didn't, you know, they functioned as their own little family, really. And they just didn't need the men in the way that we had seen on television prior to that. You know, tons of TV shows prior to that and since are about like the family, you know, the nuclear family, blah, blah, blah. This was about, you know, four women on their own, doing it up, talking very dirty, especially by the standards of the time. We had never heard anything like that. They basically, I always say, taught women how to talk about sex, or a certain kind of woman at a certain time they taught us, it was like one day we thought brunch was just like between lunch and breakfast. And then the next minute we understood that we were all supposed to go to brunch and talk about our sex lives in intimate detail with our friends. And they also had a lot of conversations about what they liked and didn't like. And again, this was all very revolutionary. This was not something you saw before. And it's, if you think about it, it's really empowering. And I read a lot of reviews from the time that indicated, I would say, if I read between the lines, that the male reviewers were pretty scared of this. You know, it's a powerful thing to have women talking about men's penis sizes, you know, that kind of thing in unflattering ways. Men don't want to know that that's going on. And women, on the other hand, you know, young women in particular at that time, which is around, you know, the turn of the millennium, found it really empowering. And I was like the absolute target audience, a little younger than them, which I think is always the best, right? You can kind of look ahead and be like, oh, look how glamorous my life's going to be soon. And you nitpick it a little less if you're not exactly that age. And it had a real effect on my life. You know, I ended an engagement, moved into New York City on my own, all of this stuff. I'm not saying just because of the show, but it definitely helped to give me a vision of what that could look like.
What year did Sex and the City premiere?
98.
And you were not yet a reporter, not working for Entertainment Weekly yet?
I was not at Entertainment Weekly. At that exact moment, I was a local newspaper reporter for the first several years of my career. So I was somewhere in there. I think I was in there at that point. Had a brief weird thing where I worked for a home decor trade magazine and then moved to New York City with my, at that time, soon to be fiance. But the really being in the city and watching that show at the same time, which truly, like, we also didn't really have like a ton of internet. Do you know what I mean? So this is so embarrassing to admit, but I had another friend in the city who I hung out with all the time, and she had just moved there too. And we would kind of just like watch the show and then go to the places they had just been to on the show that week, because we didn't know what else to do. So we'd be like, let's go to see, I mean, if we could afford it. Like, some of the stuff they did was not for us. And we did not, you know, we could not afford the clothes, any of that stuff. But like, you can afford a cupcake, or you can afford to go to Sushi Samba, maybe.
Even though those cupcakes were like $5. Even though those cupcakes were like $5, right?
Yeah, but, you know, at least I had $5. And you could, like, get a Cosmo. You know what I mean? Like, and it also would probably be overpriced. But there were things about this that were in the realm of possibility. And we weren't stupid. We knew we couldn't do everything they did. But we could do it in cheaper clothing and shoes.
Well, they also talked about, you know, as the show went on, and I remember thinking this was pretty challenging for television. They talked about the kind of domestic things that happen when you live with somebody or you marry somebody, like doing their laundry and seeing their underpants and things like that.
Yeah, it's a show that really grew up, you know what I mean, in front of us. It really started out very much with, you know, kind of the guy of the week stuff that they used to do, where it'd be like, oh, this guy has funky spunk and this guy likes to leave the bathroom door open when he pees or whatever, you know, and then be like, what do we think about that? And then it'd be on to the next guy. But eventually, you know, they got into and out of relationships. There were like real relationships, real stakes. I mean, Charlotte married the wrong man essentially and then couldn't conceive. We had, you know, Samantha dealt with breast cancer. Miranda kind of fell in love with a guy who was in a very different class than her. You know, she was a lawyer and he was a bartender, and they ended up with an unexpected pregnancy. Like, there were some massive things, and Charlotte eventually got divorced and then, you know, converted to Judaism to marry her divorce lawyer, that was one of the most touching arcs that I've seen. And it really got to be a very sort of complicated and, heartfelt at times show.
Well, how was it different than All My Children or The Bold and the Beautiful? I mean, what elevated it from that?
It's a really good question, because even as I was just talking about it now, I was sort of thinking like it wasn't really a soap opera per se, right? It wasn't like it was more like, let's delve into what this feels like for these women and also how the women supported each other during these things. And it's really, I think, you know, we're going to talk about the reboot in a bit, but I think the reboot sort of, if nothing else, underscored how hard this dance is and how well done it turned out to have been. You know, when something's seamless, you don't really notice how hard it is. But these were, they would, honestly, one of my favorite examples is that there was an episode, I think my favorite episode, where Miranda's mother dies. And it's so touching, partly because she talks about how her siblings have spouses and she doesn't, and all of her friends come to kind of be her family. And it still like gets me every time I talk about it, because it really showed the thesis of this show, which is these women are each other's family. In that same episode, Samantha also dates a wrestler and ends up like dressed up in one of those, I forget what that's called, like a singlet. Is that what that's called? The wrestler outfit?
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
And there's like a sex sequence where they're like both dressed up in wrestling outfits, and it's ridiculous. So that's a great example of the way that this show, and it felt right. Like it felt totally okay. And these were 30 minute episodes, and it was like Carrie's computer crashed and she turned it into a metaphor for her relationship. Miranda's mother died, and we've got ridiculous wrestling sex sequences. And somehow it didn't feel crazy. It all worked together. And it was such a balancing act when they did it correctly.
And it was still in the era of network television. So the show was a half hour. It didn't like, it wasn't so flexible. And not everybody could see it because you had to subscribe to HBO to see it.
That's right. And it did help to kind of establish HBO as, along with The Sopranos. This was the same. It really, I love to always point this out. It actually premiered like 6 months before it. Mm. So it really actually was the first big show on HBO before The Sopranos. And, you know, both of these shows are real showcases for what they could do on the HBO that made them different, which is they could talk about and show sex and they could do violence. And so this was their sex show.
And the show had a long run of, I don't know, 6 years, I think it was, right?
Yeah, I think it's 98 to, I think, 06, actually. And, and it does span, even it's so interesting to see it kind of spans this time. We still had a lot of network television. Of course, we still technically have it now, I'm told.
Yes, nobody watches it, but yes.
But it really kind of like spanned into like starting where no one understood, like, Why would you watch television on HBO? Like, why would you pay for television? It was crazy at the time. Yeah. And it was such a sensation that it really did lure a lot of people over to do that. And by the time it went off the air, you know, cable was it. That was like, they had won. That's what everybody was talking about. That's where all of the cool shows were.
And they're kind of the beginning of that prestige TV era.
Exactly. Like, I mean, Sopranos is definitely, I just don't think there's any way around it. Sopranos is the big bang of that prestige TV thing. But both of these shows really started that, and a big edict from the network at that time, from HBO, when they were starting it, was that we want to make TV that looks like movies. And that made sense. That actually was just their brand, because they used to be a movie channel.
Right.
So their idea was like, we can have R-rated TV shows. And they should look like movies. They should have that elevated quality of, I mean, another thing that Sex and the City pioneered is shooting on location on the streets of New York. That's another thing no one did, which sounds insane. But if you think about like Seinfeld or Friends, that's fake New York. They're both in LA, that's and it's right. Very obvious,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it had a very satisfying ending. I think it was a lovely ending when the series finished. And okay, goodbye to all of the and lovely, let it go, and that's fine. And then they had a movie.
They sure did. This is where it all begins.
And it wasn't a good movie.
No, but I would say, I mean, it's like in retrospect, I didn't hate the first movie. I didn't need it. I didn't feel like, oh, but it was fun. Like, it was a fun experience, because what I remember about it is like everyone was kind of, yeah, everyone being fans, right? Yeah. We're really excited to sort of go out and see it on opening weekend with their girlfriends. Like it was an event movie, and you kind of just were like, it had just been long enough that you were excited to hear like the Sex and the City theme song again. And, you know, it was fine. It was not, again, I would say the vitality of each of these projects like drops off with each one. And
right,
really,
there was a forgotten second movie, right?
the second movie was truly horrible. And I think that was it was really a misstep because, I mean, just because it's bad, but also I think it really started to encourage them. This sounds weird, but the second movie was so bad, though still, I think, financially reasonably successful, that I think the team really felt this need to like come back and kind of like end things the right way. And let me tell you, we have not done it yet. So this scares me because I feel like they're just going to keep trying.
You're not sure that the finale of And Just Like That is the finale, that there may be more.
I worry. I do worry for my own sanity. I worry for collective sanity of a certain women of a certain age. I worry. This just, you know, the series was not good. And the finale, you know, there's a lot of confusion. They said it was, they sort of announced like we've decided, right. But they announced that only a few weeks,
two weeks before
it aired.
Yeah. And they said they didn't want you to know in advance because blah, blah, blah.
They claimed, which seems bizarre to me, like, why would you not want to promote an entire season as this is the last chapter? You know, like, this is the thing that gets me about this. I mean, if you want to get a group of women riled up, mostly white women of a certain age, just walk into a room and, like, bring this thing up. This has been, like, therapy for all of us. Like we're targeting all of our rage at the world on this show. But frustrating experience, you know. It just was not like I said, if nothing else, you could really see how good the original was when you watch this, because it's sort of like they have a bunch of the same ingredients. I don't want to say all, because they're missing one key one, for starters, that one of the women didn't come back. But like, they've got money, you know, I mean, behind the scenes, they also were very wealthy on the screen, but they had, you know, they had a huge budget. They have HBO production values. They are supposed to know how to make television. And yet it was like the weirdest thing because it looked so good, but it was all wrong. And it was a constant feeling of like, no, these characters are not acting like the way that I am sure they would, which is a very odd experience.
We're talking with Jennifer Armstrong. She's the author of many wonderful books on popular culture and its history. And she's also got a Substack that's really great called the Ministry of Pop Culture. Is that what it's called?
That is what it's called.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I love it. And were the same people behind the scenes involved in this second series?
To some extent. So the actual creator of the show is Darren, of the original is Darren Star, but he did not even stay with that show for the whole time. Mm. He's also the guy who made Melrose Place, if that gives you any, you know, and he has since gone on to make the specific viewing experience known as Emily in Paris.
Yes,
that's another one that
loves.
People
yeah.
kind of like hate watch. I don't know if that's quite the right word for it. It's just, it's like satisfying, but kind of annoying and kind of cringy, but kind of fun.
Yeah.
And beautiful. And so Michael Patrick King took over the original from Darren, around season two. And so he's been the guiding force ever since. He has been the king of Sex and the City. So that's the two movies and this. So, you know, it should have the same, you know, it should have the same vision. A couple of the writers of the original came back. I always wonder if maybe not enough of them did, because I do think that a huge part of, and no disrespect to Michael Patrick King, who's done many good things in television, but like it, you know, the original, a huge part of my book, is about the women who wrote it. And what would happen is they were all literally single women in New York City at this time.
Yeah.
And they would actually, they had a bus that would take them to the studio, which I think is just funny. So this bus or this van would come and pick them up in the city and take them over to Queens, which is where the studio was. And they'd all get in the van in the morning and like talk about their night before. And then that would kind of form the basis of what they were going to talk about at work. They'd get to work and kind of give the highlights to Michael and he'd write them on the board. And then they'd kind of debate like which ones of these things are going to go directly into the show. So it was a very direct conversation of like women living this life, using stuff from their own lives to fuel that show. And I really believe that was the secret sauce, is like, that's why women like me could watch it and feel like, yes, that's my life. I get this. And I don't know what the process has been on and just like that. And I don't really know as much about the writers, but it feels a little, there was a little bit of offness in terms of like what, for instance, I and many people thought was the show was going to be versus what we got. I kind of thought it was going to do the same for like 50 something women that it did for 30 something women, that it was going to say like, actually, girls, you know, you might have your ups and downs, but being postmenopausal is kind of cool, you know, like that doesn't feel like what I got. I feel like I got a show about ultra rich people who acted like idiots the whole time.
Well, when you and I first talked about this show, when it first came on, and I had only seen the first episode, and I complained to you that it was awful and that the acting was bad and stiff. There was something really, you know, awkward about it. And you were saying, no, it's good. Just wait.
I told you. Yeah. I had this thing where I was always like, no. It's gonna get better any second. And then now I have to just admit, like, there was, in the last back half of this season, I had to be like, it's not going to get better.
I read somewhere about some people feeling that the show was, in fact, sort of shaming these women for growing old. And did you feel that?
I definitely felt that. I felt there were definitely times when I remembered, like sometimes I'd be writing it, you're watching it for work, and I'd write down things like, why does the show hate these women? There was something I can't quite figure out. I have like vague theories about it, but that, yeah, it just felt like we went from kind of celebrating these women in the first iteration to it really felt like humiliating them constantly. I mean, in the series finale, the last scene on screen that we have of Miranda Hobbs is that she's literally cleaning up shit. Like, there is a toilet overflow situation, which we see. And that is her final act. Like, to me, that is it. That summarizes the entire thing. It just felt like everything, the men kind of had problems too. Like, the men were humiliated too. Like, Harry had to like pee his pants once because his fly got stuck. And like, it also often felt like they were a good 10 years older than they actually are. Like, Carrie got a hip replacement. There were so many things. Plus, there was a constant feeling of just like things not making sense, which was different from the humiliation of it all. But they literally, you know, the characters often would do things that made no sense. The plots would make no sense. So it was just like a very frustrating experience all around, but it was such a bummer because I really thought when they first started, oh, they're going to come on and they're going to be like, yeah, you know, again, ups and downs, but being, you know, postmenopausals can still be glamorous. And instead it was just kind of like, I guess you'll be really rich, but also very sad and kind of constantly acting stupid. That's what I got from this.
Well, Cynthia Nixon, at the same time that she was on this show, she was doing incredible work on The Gilded Age, which I think is really a marvelous program. I don't know if you're a fan of this show.
Wild. It's just such a weird thing. I'm always like, did she negotiate some kind of dual contract with HBO? Did she know the whole time, like, look, I'm going to do this one thing, but I got to get to do this other thing? I don't know. She's such a good actress.
Yeah.
She just is. That's the part, the thing about her that's always been true. I mean, I loved all the women on the original series, but I always thought she, you know, yeah. I wouldn't want to act next to Cynthia Nixon either, is what I would say, because I just think she's so good.
Have you been watching the Gilded Age?
I have not, but I watched it at the beginning, and I know people are like losing their minds about it this season.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that is interesting about it is that so many great Broadway players are in it, you know, Brian Stokes Mitchell and Audra McDonald and Felicia Rashad, all these people who are Tony winners, or Nathan Lane, doing really great work on this program. It's a good show.
That's great. I'm glad that something good is happening. I chose the wrong lane on HBO.
Well, they didn't consult with you at all about the storyline. They didn't say, let's check in with Jennifer.
No, I'm so sad. The funny thing is, and this is true also of a lot of the discussions that people have amongst themselves, it's like everybody has ideas. Every time I've talked to somebody about this, we've come up with like what we believe. And granted, I know I understand how annoying this is to TV writers, where it's like, yeah, it's cool you had that idea, but you didn't have to execute it. But we came up with so many other things we wish we had seen, and we just don't. That kind of, I think this is part of, this is like where you get into the philosophy of reboots. But, you know, I think we feel like we know the characters so well from watching the original that when you go in a different direction, there's just alarm bells that go off, which I guess is this, you know, it's just being human. It's human instinct. If somebody's acting weird, you know why, you know, maybe you don't know why, but you know that it's something's off. And this felt like three seasons of that, where you're just like, these are not the people that you originally presented me with and made me fall in love with. And it felt often as if they were like ritually destroying them in front of us.
Yeah. You know?
That was the part that was so hard. You can't make us love them and then make them such a part of our lives and then just like destroy them in front of us. I don't know if they didn't have a sense of what these people meant to us. I think it's possible. Like, I think it's weird that, you know, there's a different perspective from the inside of a show.
If they
versus
can, they want to make money, I guess, is the bottom line. But
well, unfortunately, yeah. I would say that is probably the biggest motivator. And, you know, if you remember, media has been so strange the last few years, but this was one of the first shows that was on, like, when they had the streaming platform, when it was like, oh, we're just going to have, like, not HBO, but like the streaming platform for HBO, which I don't remember what we were calling it then. Was it HBO Max?
HBO Max, and then it was Max, and now it's HBO Max again.
So I think this was around the launch of HBO Max, the streamer.
Yeah.
And the idea was you can only get this by getting the streamer. And this was one of the lures to get people over there. So I don't know the specifics of their deals, but I am sure money trucks were backed up in the process of this, and all three of the main actresses were executive producers, which can mean more creative control if they want it, but really also means more money.
More money for them.
And, you know, that's one way of kind of like padding a contract. And I'm sure that that was a huge motivator here. I also theorize that in the grand scheme of things, if you do a show like this, and then you're so happy when it's, I think, you know, to some extent you can be so happy when it's over. Great, I get to do other things. And then eventually I think you realize like, crap, that was the best role I ever had in my life. And especially, I'm sorry to say, for women over 50, I would guess that the roles were not just, you know,
pouring in,
lining up. And so you kind of have this urge, like maybe we should go back. Maybe I can play that character I love again. And this is what we get. And this is why we get reboots. Unfortunately, I'm hard pressed to name a reboot that was like a genuinely good idea, like that enhanced the series.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's generally thought of as, you know, sequels and reboots are money grabs, right? I mean, I think maybe the kind of the continuation of the X-Files when they had seasons 9 and 10, they were kind of like the X-Files, and they weren't really bothersome. You didn't go, oh, I'm sorry they did that, the way they did with The Godfather Part 3. It's like, oh, how could they destroy our, you know, somebody said the worst thing about Rocky is Rocky 2, 3, 4, 5. And I think that's generally true. We get, they kind of, you know, destroy our favorite things by making sequel number 7.
Yeah. And I mean, I have ideas for why that's true. And I mean, I think the main one is just that, you know, something I've said over and over again about this one in particular is we talked at the beginning about how important Sex and the City was and what it did. And so it had a point of view and a mission that was vital to its time. And it certainly also had problems, but like generally speaking, it was doing something. And this just came in, you know, with the main mission of making money for these people. And it felt, I could feel that more and more as it went on. It started to feel so sort of dark and cynical. And then I got extra angry whenever I would like read interviews with them or listen to interviews with them trying to defend the show, because it, their defense often became like, well, people just don't get it. People don't get our great toilet overflowing humor. And it made me so angry in a way that I don't normally get about stuff like this, because I was like, you can't do all this and then you can't disrespect the fans and then disrespect us some more. You know, you can't make the show so disrespectful and then go out and be like, no, you're the idiot. You just don't get our high art. And it just made me angry.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, sometimes I think that's the case. I mean, when I show, I'm a film appreciation teacher, so I'll show an earlier film like Citizen Kane and they say, well, it's boring and we don't like it. And I'd say, well, that's because you don't know enough about why it's great. And let me help you understand. But I don't think that applies to And Just Like That.
You don't think it's the Citizen Kane of reboots?
Possibly not. But, you know, you're just saying that the original show was a product of its time. And so, you know, the time that we're in now, and I should mention to our listeners that Jennifer was a reporter for Entertainment Weekly during that magazine's golden age. And one of the things that she covered was The Apprentice and its host. I forget the host's name.
But, you know, some guy, business guy, so, alleged businessman.
So do you think that And Just Like That is a product of this time? And does it reflect that in any way?
I wish it were. Like, this is where I think reboots could be genuinely interesting. But it's hard because they're always balancing, like, what, you know, fan service and what, like, they've kind of been hired to do is nostalgia. So it's tough to then become a product. But that's what I had wanted more of, is like, first of all, in the, what I call menaissance, we are all talking about menopause all of a sudden. And I'm thrilled about that. But like, how did they not address that or aging? I mean, they didn't really. There's like some aging stuff, but like, I would have welcomed more conversations about like, what work are you getting done or what, you know, like how hard it is to be a woman aging in public and all of these things. And then more to the, you know, I don't know how the original was not very political, almost notoriously so, but it was a less political time. So you could get away with that. They had a whole episode where Carrie dated a politician and they like made sex jokes about why they don't vote. Like, you would never do that now, but they just didn't like acknowledge it at all. I think they acknowledged COVID when they first came on because it had been, you know, not that long. So it was more like, aren't we glad to be out again kind of thing. And after that, there's been no indication of like what era we're in besides it's one of the things that really was obsessed with, especially when it first came on, which you know from watching the beginning, is that they were very obsessed with proving to everyone how, quote, woke they were. They were dropping a lot of like, you know, non-binary, what's your pronouns? They gave each woman a woman of color as an accessory, in my opinion. They did not do a good job of those actual storylines. So they just like gave each of the main three women like a friend of color, which is not really the way to fix this. But they were very into like trying to say like, we're cool now. We know how to like, we know we didn't do this stuff then, but we're going to do it now. But mostly all it became was like this show about unbelievably rich people, which I guess maybe is.
That's right. That's what's happening.
It's a show about clueless, very, very wealthy people who may not even understand just how wealthy they are in relation to other people, which could be about our times, but I don't think it meant to be.
Maybe it is. I mean, when we talk about the challenges of, the second Trump administration and how horrible things are getting and how a fascist takeover is happening. If you're among the, you know, the 1%, then you're not going to really be affected by it and you don't have to worry about it.
It's true. And they were not. So maybe this was all, maybe we didn't get it.
That's right. You just don't get it.
Maybe it was a brilliant comment on our time.
But then they would have hired somebody to come in and clean up their toilet, I believe.
It's true. They're like, no, Miranda can do it.
Yeah, because I certainly would. Yes. Well, what are you afraid of? Where do you think they would go with it? Do you think they'll come back with something else? Is that the?
I think it would be. I mean, part of me is like, God, that seems impossible. Like, how much can you run this into the ground? But I also do feel, and I want to say, by the way, just like, I feel so bad about this. And I think I was so hopeful about this show for so long because they were very nice to me when I did the book. Like, yeah. These people were so generous and like talked to me and opened up their world to me. And I feel so grateful for that part. And I get that it's just weird on the inside of a show like this, you know, that you just don't see what we see. But, I worry about this tendency. We've seen this pattern that you and I were just talking about is like, I really feel like, and not just them, like everybody needs to leave stuff alone, especially if you did an okay job ending it. I had quarrels with the original ending, but like, it was a nice episode of television, you know, yeah. Like it was nice in that way. Like I don't love Big, but I don't love that she ended up with Big, but like, in retrospect, I'm like, leave it alone. You had a beautiful dress and a romantic thing and people went to Paris and came back and you did it. You did the thing. This way, just let it live in their imaginations.
It was a comedy also. The first show was a comedy. And I didn't, yes. I didn't find that many funny things in the second show. I mean, it started with Big's death, right? I mean, he died of...
You didn't think Che Diaz, the alleged comedian character, was funny?
There needed to be a lot more humor for it to be a comedy.
Yeah, I think that they believed, I truly believe this, that one of the problems was that the humiliation factor that we were all sensing in it.
Yeah.
You know, the original got a lot of humor from undercutting them. Think of even the beginning credits is mm-hmm. like a perfect example, but they did this all the time where she's like glamorous and walking through the cities, you know, streets of New York, and she sees herself on a bus. And it's like, how cool is that? She has a column and she's on the side of a bus and then the bus splashes her, right?
Right, right.
And that's I mean, I always thought it was so brilliant because that's what I think the show often did quite well in its day is like, look how glamorous these women are. And then they'd experience some kind of like awful like sex thing or relationship thing or just kind of a way of saying like, yes, they have a glamorous life, but it's still... has its bumps. Whereas I think they thought they were doing that here and they maybe just went way overboard with the humiliation or it felt different at this age. I'm not sure there was something off about that. I think my point is that I think they may have thought a lot of the humiliation was quote humor. Yeah. and I don't think a lot of us received it that way. I mean, I keep thinking about how Harry got, I guess, testicular cancer. Harry got some kind of cancer.
Never funny. Cancer is not funny.
Well, they made it something because for like 3 minutes on the show, it was, oh my God, this is so sad and upsetting. And then it just became like jokes all the time. He would just constantly talk about how big his balls were all the time because of his treatment. And that was like most of what I got from him in the last few episodes and how he could not get an erection. And it was just like, this is not funny or fun for me. It's just, it was always, there was like so many embarrassing and like cringe moments, but not in the office, this is funny way.
Right. Well, when you look back at the old series that you wrote such a great book about, Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live and Love. Do you find moments that don't play in today's enlightened society?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is part of what they were sort of, they started to try to atone for. You know, it's famously just very white, especially for a New York show.
Yeah.
You know, even supporting characters or whatever, it's like these people never met people of color. So there's that, you know, they were pretty privileged. And, you know, then there's like specific real clunkers, which is just true of any show from the early 2000s. There's one that I just call the racist episode where Samantha dates a black man and it is just harrowing. Oh, I mean, just wall to wall stereotypes for him and his sister. It's so, he's like hip hop producer, because that's the only job a black man can have. She's a soul food chef, because that's the only job a black woman could have. Like, it just gets worse and worse. So that one's terrible. There's one where Samantha fights with some trans prostitutes in her new neighborhood in the meatpacking district that is hard to watch in parts. There's a very strange episode where Carrie dates a bisexual guy and she says, like, she doesn't believe in bisexuality. Like, you should pick a side, like, all of this stuff. I mean, it wasn't, it had gay men on it, but it was not exactly like sexually fluid other than that. It was just kind of like a very specific kind of gay man. And, you know, that's, which also is almost like used as a status marker, I feel like, for women to some extent in this situation. So, you know, there were definitely things about it that were not great. But, you know, if you watch Friends, same thing's true.
Yeah, it's interesting how shows from that era, you know, like Friends, have that. Whereas, and Seinfeld to a certain extent too. But, you know, I Love Lucy doesn't have that stuff.
It's weird, isn't it? And I always, something that I keep beating this drum that, you know, I wrote a book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And I just think, like, I'm not sure why this hasn't had the same afterlife, but I feel like the kids would love it. It holds up so well. I have rewatched it a number of times and I cannot find stuff that's actually a problem. I think the kids would all love it. Like, the only problem is that, yes, it could be more diverse. But other than that, like, and it does deal at times with some racial stuff. It certainly deals with Rhoda's Jewishness. The, you know.
And there is a black character.
The gay episode's great. The, you know, like, there's just a number of things that are just actually incredibly well done. I think in the 2000s in particular, there was this idea of being edgy. And that one of the ways you were edgy was that you'd, like, go there. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You would say the stuff that other people didn't want you to say. And that's 30 Rock has some clunkers for this reason. Friends has gay jokes every 5 seconds. I can't figure out what their problem was.
They're very homophobic on that show.
Yeah, I rewatched it not that long ago. And I was like, this is actually, like, truly at least once an episode, there's a homophobic joke. It's very strange.
The Mary Tyler Moore Show also, unlike Just Like That, is really, really funny.
Yes. It really, that's such a good example of, like, this is why I love that show so much, of being able, first of all, to combine feelings, right? There's some real pathos in a lot of the episodes, yeah. And being funny. And it's also so, and maybe this is why they could do that. It's so character driven. Like, it's funny because Lou would do the thing, or, like, Mary would hate this, or Rhoda would love that. And that, or characters in conflict, you know, Sue Ann, like, I mean, everyone watch it to see Betty White on fire. That's my, I just feel like she was, like, in a zone on that show that I cannot even deal with. I mean,
it was shocking. I mean, from someone who was watching it at the time, it was shocking because, you know, we had a picture of Betty White as being square.
Right.
And so when she said the things that she said, and she doesn't say anything obscene because it's network television, but still daring and hilarious. And that show was really, truly funny. And it's a lot of people now lionize MASH. MASH has become one of the touchstones. And MASH definitely went on too long. I mean, the last several seasons of MASH became very preachy and much less funny. And Mary Tyler Moore had a brief run, really.
7 years.
Yeah.
Which is the magic number for syndication, probably not coincidentally. A lot of shows want to get to that number for financial reasons. But that was one of the shows, one of the earlier shows to end of its own volition.
Right.
And by the way, they announced it at the beginning of their season.
Yes, this will be our final season. And they had a beautiful final episode. That's
one of the greatest finales.
And funny and all those things.
Really, I mean, gold standard finale. I know it gets harder all the time because more and more things have been done as you go along.
Yeah.
But, like, it's, again, this is, they were such craftsmen on that show. And Jim and Alan understood, the creators of the show, like, they knew how to make TV, you know what I mean? And they knew how to have a thesis for their show, and they knew exactly what their mission was. And that means if you know what your mission is, it's not as hard to end it, because the ending always tells you what it was about. And that's why, I mean, it's like Friends isn't a great, great finale, but like it makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, all the friends are going to have to grow up and like not live near each other anymore. And that's going to be the natural ending. And that's sad. The Mary Tyler Moore Show did that brilliant thing where it's like, the best thing to do is to have the characters saying goodbye to each other so that the audience feels like
they're saying goodbye.
They're saying goodbye. And, you know, to have the station where Mary works get bought out and they all lose their jobs is just like brilliant and perfect and emotional. And that's the way you do it. You know, don't have to do a bunch of crazy stuff. You just have to like know what you're trying to say. But it's a problem if you don't know what you're trying to say.
Now, another lesson that Sex and the City might have taken from the Mary Tyler Moore Show is Mary and Rhoda, I think it was called, the really unfunny, short-lived reboot that they did.
That's a really good point. That's a very good point that even the best of us, I mean, even the best of us should not attempt reboots is really what we learn from that. You get that high, it's like a sugar high to me. It's a high-carb situation is what a reboot is. It's like, you get that initial boost of just like, oh, they didn't use the music for Sex and the City for And Just Like That. So we didn't get that part, but still, just, I remember seeing them together on screen again and getting emotional because like that's how much this show meant to me.
Yeah.
And so I rode that for a little while of just being like, no, I love seeing them. It's New York City. They're together. I feel great. I feel good that they're still friends, like all of that stuff. And then after a while, you're just like, what are we doing? We're just like eating these empty calories of seeing these people. And it's never the same. It's like the best you can hope for is not doing damage. Is, you know, like you said about the X-Files, it's like, yeah, it's fine. That's, you know, when they brought back Twin Peaks briefly, that was okay. Cause it was just like, here's some more weird stuff. And then
everyone had
stopped
watching Twin Peaks after the first season anyway. So it didn't matter.
That's true. And I watched the Will and Grace reboot and it was one of the better ones. And I would say it's because they were like, they weirdly were able to just hold exactly steady. They like made up a reason that Will and Grace were back together in the apartment again. It was like, she's getting a divorce. He's getting, I don't know, whatever. Guess they're both getting divorces. I don't remember. And then they just did their exact same thing. And they all, by the way, aged beautifully. So that helped. It just felt like watching more of the same. And that was the best you could do. It was like, I don't remember one episode of that, but like you went, I at least didn't like actively it didn't change my good memories of the original. Whereas this has been such a like screwing around in your mind. It feels like you've been having like recurring bad dreams about people you used to love. Like that's what it feels like.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's better to end and have people go, oh, too bad it ended. I wish there were more.
You want to always, right? Do we not know this rule of show business? They've never been able to do it. And the funny thing about you mentioning like, the sequels, movie sequels, you know, back in the day used to be like this big thing. And I don't know, it's like it took on such a reputation that you almost went into sequels being like, this will probably suck, but that's fine.
Yeah.
So it almost could like, The Godfather is a little bit of an exception, I think, because of the quality of the original, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But like most of the time you'd just be like, oh, I'm going to go see like The Hangover 3 and it's probably going to be dumb. But that's fine.
Right.
And somehow it ended up eventually to people who kind of understood the meta narrative. You just kind of like go into it with such low expectations that it didn't matter. But a TV show takes up so much of your life. You have to, especially
it's
this
every week.
Was like
right.
weekly, you know, this wasn't even a binge dump. This is going to take, you know, 12 weeks of our lives. And what's funny, I will tell you the one funny thing to me is that this got to be such a bonding activity complaining about this show that I talked to a number of women, including myself, where we were all like, are you a little bit sad? Like, we were like a little sad that we wouldn't get to do this, like, and another, I often call the show and another thing. Why is Aiden still here? You know, like. It just
so it, even though I it was think, terrible, you will miss it, is what you're saying.
Yeah. It was such an intense. It wasn't, you know, like something like the Will and Grace thing. It didn't really give you the fuel. You would just watch it and be like, that was fine. this just gave so much fuel of like, I'm mad at every single thing that happened on the show this week, you know?
Well, maybe something else.
Like almost like Severance or something. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like Severance, you try to figure out the mysteries every week. This was just like trying to figure out the mystery of like, but why were so many people peeing in this episode? You know, the final episode had two separate scenes of men in the bathroom peeing. I do not know why.
The thing that you were just saying about that we were talking about Mary Tyler Moore and how they brought everybody together to say goodbye. And at the end of, and just like that, they didn't bring everybody together.
No, it was one of my biggest complaints about this entire situation is like, wow, how far you've drifted. If you cannot even the kicker on that, this is very typical of the show. This is why we all get infuriated. Not only did we not get a scene of the three main ladies together, it was an episode about Thanksgiving. You have already made the mechanism for which you can bring these three quite busy women together by saying they're all going to be together on Thanksgiving. And then they made a reason for each of them to not be there. So we never got the three of them at the same time. And then the final scenes were Carrie alone and like a weird little montage of the other ones at their own homes. It's baffling.
And there was no effort to bring the fourth woman back like they had done sort of halfway through this. Theories,
right? Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, they, you know, we had these kind of like secondary characters who are women of color. And I just don't feel like, I mean, they couldn't even get the original three together, generally speaking. This is not just this episode. It's just often the case that this show is constant phone calls. People were just always calling each other, giving recaps.
You can't have brunch on a phone call.
Yeah, no, it's not the same. And like, they were not concerned about realism in any other way. So why not just like pretend they could get together for brunch. Anyway, they just didn't. I mean, they couldn't even get the three together. So, of course, yes, the other two women who we sort of added were kind of left adrift and they just could not quite get like real story. I mean, I'm not sure they got story momentum on anybody, but they certainly could not get it for those two women. And especially the character of Seema, Sarita Chaudhry, I just feel so bad for her. I can't help feeling like there was a point at which you could almost see her delivering her lines and being like, I know, I just have to say this. I'm sorry. This is dumb. Well, I know it is.
Well, if you combine this failure with, say, the lack of interest in Marvel movies that are continuous and that's really kind of petered out, maybe the era of reboots and sequels is coming to a blessed end.
I hope so. I mean, I don't think there's been so many, if you think about it, they've always been with us. We've called them different things. I don't know the difference between a reboot and a sequel, for instance. I think technically reboots started out being more like a reboot would have been maybe a better idea, like for new young women,
yeah,
kind of in the same mold. But we just kind of call everything reboots now. But yeah, I hope so. I think we could use more original ideas. It's fine to also always dabble in the nostalgia. I get it. It's powerful. But sometimes I feel like I'm living in this world where like everything's just like rehashed. It's like there's no new ideas anymore. It's like there's literally no new. I mean, like we used to get a When Harry Met Sally or a, you know, whatever, like when I used to go to the movies,
something new.
I remember how exciting it was that you'd get all of this, as we say now, original IP, you know, and now everything is rehashed IP from the past. And it means we're not saying anything vital anymore with our work. And it's a problem.
Well, Jennifer, you have a new book coming out. Tell us a little bit about that.
I do. In the spring, we will have a book about the television show Parks and Rec, and it is called Parks and Rec.
There must be a subtitle, a very long subtitle.
There is. Let's get that.
You're not even sure what it is.
I have not memorized this one yet. Okay. Exactly. The underdog TV show that literally inspired a vision for a better America. So get ready to say that.
All right.
On your show in the future, because
you're coming.
It's happening.
Back.
It has the best cover in the world. We just unveiled that, and I'm very excited about it because they were just such a delight. It was just a really uplifting whole experience. Everyone that I talked to involved with it was so wonderful, and seems like they loved each other a lot. It still do. And just had such a good time making this thing. And it really does have an uplifting message. So I'm very excited about being able to talk about that in these times.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to reading that and seeing you again very soon then.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cation Armstrong, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.